you've done, and then we will decide on your punishment.
And if I don't?
Jimmy asked.
Then we will undo what you've done and punish you.
Jimmy shook his head.
That's not much of a choice. Eh, but you never were a very good negotiator, were you, Philip?
He chuckled, but when it was clear that he was the only one who saw anything funny, he stopped. He took a long moment to gauge the mood of the wizards, who stood as a unified block behind Philip.
Okay, I'll tell you what. If any of you agree with Philip, stay there with him. If you understand what I've done and see that it was the right way forward, then come stand with me.
Nobody, not even Eddie, moved to stand with Jimmy.
I see,
he said.
All righty then, Philip. If what I've done is a terrible crime for which I must be punished, then I suggest you get on with it.
He laid his staff on the ground and crossed his arms in front of himself, as if waiting patiently for a police officer to handcuff him. Philip walked forward. He removed his hat and muttered,
Schnuro gvar mitroin,
to produce some rope. As he reached into his hat, he said,
Well, Jimmy, I won't pretend that I'm not going to enjoy this.
Philip reached his hand into his hat and grasped, but got nothing but a handful of air. He tried a couple more times, perplexed. He was puzzling over this when he walked face first into the invisible exclusion field between him and Jimmy. Philip bounced off of the wall, sprawling backwards onto the grass, yelping with surprise. Jimmy said,
I must admit, I enjoyed that quite a bit as well.
He bent down and picked his staff back up. Martin and Gwen ran to Philip's side as he lay on the ground 5 feet in front of where Jimmy stood. Philip sat up, feeling his nose to see if it was broken. Jimmy said,
You'll find that the entire city of Camelot is surrounded by an exclusion field, the largest ever attempted. That's what I had to rush to get finished when Tyler turned out to be such a wuss. You're gonna love this part. The magic phrase that activated it was, All righty then, Philip. You see, I always knew you'd turn on me someday.
I turned on you years ago,
Philip cried from his seated position on the ground.
You think I didn't know that? You didn't hide your hostility very well, Philip.
I didn't hide it at all. I've been openly hostile.
Well,
Jimmy sniffed,
don't think for 1 minute that I was fooled by your false friendship.
I hate you. I hate you. I've hated you openly for years.
And finally, the truth comes out.
Philip shouted inarticulately for a while, too mad to care that he was giving Jimmy just what he wanted. Finally, he stopped and hoisted himself to his feet, picking up his staff and hat.
You won't be needing those,
Jimmy said.
I've disabled the shell on that side of the field. If any of you had come over to stand with me, you'd still have your powers and full access to the shell. But instead, you cut off. The shell will ignore you as long as you're out there. So, pretty much for the rest of your lives.
Martin shouted,
You won't get away with this, Jimmy! I've already gotten away with it. It just took you cretins this long to notice. And my name is Merlin!
Jimmy composed himself, then continued,
Of course, since the shell doesn't work at all out there, I can't use magic against you either.
None of the wizards on the wrong side of the barrier were surprised when Jimmy continued.
So, I'll just have to sick my orcs on you instead.
Philip was in a full rage.
They aren't orcs, you idiot! Just because you call something something doesn't make it it!
Jimmy shook his head.
Oh, Philip, you've always lacked imagination. As that last sentence proved.
26. The wizards quickly discovered that having free access to all of the food, shelter, and money you could ever want, and the ability to teleport and fly, was not conducive to good cardiovascular health. They didn't know for sure if disabling the shell had rendered them just as prone to injury as a non-wizard, but not one of them chose to stick around and find out. The wizards ran less than 100 feet before most of them were winded. Also, due to the unevenness of the field through which they were running, Most of them almost immediately pulled, wrenched, or twisted some part of their anatomy. Martin was among the most physically fit among them, but that was only because he had arrived most recently. The wizards were running for their lives and were doing a terrible job of it. Luckily, the orcs weren't doing much better. At Merlin's order, all 500 of them advanced on the now powerless wizards, but they moved clumsily, grumbling as they did. Clearly, the process of turning into orcs was even more uncomfortable than Merlin had let on. This was good because it meant the wizards had some chance of escape. It was bad in that it meant that if they were captured, the orcs would be in the mood for revenge. Martin noticed that he was pulling away from the pack, and he fought his natural instinct to widen the gap. Instead, he took the opportunity to slow a bit and look behind him. The little band of wizards had a lead on the orcs, but Martin knew it wouldn't last. The wizards had accelerated well, but they couldn't keep it up for long, and while the solid wall of orcs was slow, he saw no reason to believe it would get any slower. Martin looked to the tree line, still hundreds of yards away. He didn't think the wizards would make it. Several of them were already clutching at their sides. Even if they did reach the forest, there was no reason to think that the orcs wouldn't chase them into it. Really, the forest would most likely just split the wizards up and make them easier to capture. Martin felt his imp box with his smartphone inside, rattling around in his robe pocket and beating against his left hip as he ran. It was maddening. His robe, his hat, his staff, his phone, all of them had been so powerful just 10 minutes ago, but now they were as useless as if the shell had never existed.
"Hang on," Martin thought. "My phone could do stuff before Philip told me about the shell. That's how I got here."
He risked turning around and running backwards for a moment.
"Hey, Phil!"
he yelled.
"He said he disabled the shell, right?"
Philip was badly winded and losing speed. He spoke between huge gulps of air.
"Yeah? So, what?"
"He didn't say he disabled the file, just the shell."
"Yeah, it's really hard to cut someone off from the file. We can do it, but it takes a lot of doing. You can't rush it."
Martin didn't say anything. He just dug out the silver imp box and showed it to Philip. Philip looked puzzled for a moment, then started screaming,
"Do it! Do it now! Do it!"
Martin flipped the lid of the box open. The smartphone screen glowed invitingly. He pulled up the app and looked at the options. He could go back to his own time and be arrested like a civilized person.
No thanks.
He could teleport himself away and watch from a distance as his friends got beaten to death. That much better. That left one option. He pressed the hover button and immediately bobbed 2 feet into the air. He heard a ragged cheer come up from the other wizards, but he was more concerned with the bone-jarring vibration he'd never bothered to fix. Also, with his feet no longer touching the ground, he was quickly losing speed. Philip must have noticed this too, because he grabbed Martin's sleeve and started pulling him through the air behind him.
"Okay,"
Martin said, sounding like a goat sitting on a paint shaker.
"I proved it works! I'm gonna stop now!"
Philip yelled,
"Don't you dare! I've got an idea!"
He maneuvered Martin's vibrating body so that he was skimming along 2 feet above the ground, head first and face down like Superman. Martin was wondering what Philip had in mind when he felt Philip jump into the air and land with his knee in the middle of Martin's back. Martin let out a pained yell as Philip started kicking the ground, propelling them forward, riding Martin like a scooter. Martin started to complain, but Philip cut him off, saying,
"Pipe down! You owe me one!"
"Okay, who else has a pocket computer that can access the repository file?"
Philip yelled. A disappointingly small number of voices answered. Martin couldn't be sure, but he thought he heard three. Gwen and Jeff were two of them.
"Right," Philip said. "We need a diversion. Ideas?"
An endless moment passed. Then Jeff said,
"You know what? I think I got something. I gotta stop running to do this. Keep going, no matter what happens to me."
Gary yelled,
"Done!"
All who knew him realized that this was what passed for an expression of concern from him. Martin was still being used as a hoverboard. He hung his head down so that he could have an unobstructed but inverted view behind them. He saw that the wizards had opened a lead of about 100 feet. He could also see that Jeff had stopped running and turned to face the groaning, limping mass of orcs. His head was bowed, and he was clearly operating some sort of electronic device, but Martin couldn't see what it was. As the orcs closed the gap, Jeff raised his eyes to meet them. They were about 30 feet away when he made the final key press. Martin could hardly see the orcs. His view was obstructed by a massive army of demons. They were 10 feet tall, with pinkish-red skin on their top halves. Their legs were brown fur and ended in cloven hooves. Their snarling, animalistic faces were framed by large, curled horns. Their fists glowed green with arcane energy. There were hundreds of them, standing between Jeff and the orcs, lined up like hellish rockets. In the gaps between the demon's arms and legs, Martin could see just enough to get a sense of the panic in the orc ranks. One instant, they were jogging toward the wizards. The next, they were sprinting away. They continued to grumble, but much more emphatically. It struck Martin as odd that the demons were facing the wizards, with their backs to the orcs, but he was willing to accept that. The wizards did not need to be told to stop running. They stood in the tall grass a few hundred feet from the tree line, gasping for air and clutching their sides. Philip lifted his knee from Martin's back. Martin vibro-floated a few feet while he poked at his smartphone. Then he dropped to the ground and lay there, grateful to be alive and stationary. After a moment, he got up and joined the other wizards, who were watching Jeff's demon army chase off the orcs. Martin watched the battle as he walked around the back of the clutch of wizards. Now that he was standing upright, the demons looked familiar. It helped that they still appeared to be facing Martin, even as they chased the orcs back to Camelot. Martin wondered why they were running backwards, but then he realized that some of them were running sideways, and that they were all moving in an odd, herky-jerky manner. Martin smiled, then moved 10 feet to his left, still watching the demons. They all rotated to face him, no matter where he was, like animated cardboard cutouts of demons. Martin laughed, then yelled, "Jeff! Doom?"
"Yep," Jeff replied. "They're called Barons of Hell. They were level bosses from the first game. They showed up again in Doom 2, I think. I don't have all the frames imported or the sounds. I didn't think I'd need them yet."
Jeff turned to Gary.
"I was going to give you one as a pet for Christmas."
One of the Magnuses from Norway said,
"I will buy 10. Name your price."
The demons didn't run very fast, but neither did the orcs. Jeff had time to enact a few more subroutines, enabling the demons to turn sideways and to throw green fireballs, which seemed to enable the orcs to run faster. A few orcs were hit in the back by fireballs and were too scared to even notice that the fireballs had no effect. The terrified orcs crowded through a side portal into the city wall like 500 Three Stooges, slamming a portcullis down behind them.
"Can you make more of those?" Gwen asked.
"How many you want?"
"Enough to make sure the orcs stay inside for a while?"
"Sure," Jeff said. "The hard part was writing an emulator so the game's code would run out here. Now that I've done that, I can make as many as we need. They'll just wander around, attacking anything that moves."
Jeff hit a few buttons, did some thumb typing, and suddenly the field was full of Barons of Hell, wandering about and throwing green fireballs at random. The only sound was the chirping of birds and the wind rustling the trees.
"Like I said, I haven't imported the sound files yet," Jeff explained.
"Clearly Jimmy didn't stick around to watch his orcs dispatch us, or else he'd have retaliated by now,"
David, the wizard from Russia, said as a demon punched him ineffectually in the back of the head.
"Agreed,"
Philip said, his back aglow in pixelated green fire from repeated fireball strikes.
"We need to get back into the city."
Martin looked at his smartphone, wedged into its decorative box. Two demons were standing on either side of him, silently struggling to kill each other through him as if he weren't there.
"I can transport myself in there no problem, but I've never tried to take another person with me, let alone 20.
Gwen pulled out a smartphone as a demon walked through her, possibly attempting to kick her. Martin assumed from the phone's shape and the logo that it was an iPhone 6. She squinted at the screen, saying,
"I can transport anyone with this, but I don't have a UI, just the raw file. I'll have to do it one person at a time, and I'll need the hard coordinates of the exact landing spot. Anybody have some safe coordinates inside the city memorized?"
After a conspicuous silence, Eddie looked at her phone, noticing the logo on the back.
"Apple? They're still in business?"
Jeff said,
"You're from the early 90s, aren't you?"
His portable, from just a few years after Martin's time, appeared to be two sheets of glass glued together into a rectangle. The back sheet of glass was opaque. The front held the display. Martin didn't see a logo, which probably meant it wasn't made by Apple. One of the Germans had a Palm Trio that looked like it was designed by a committee of lowest bidders. Martin didn't think it would be as much use as Gwen's iPhone. By this time, the wizards had formed into a loose huddle, and the demons had surrounded them, pelting their backs with a constant barrage of 16-bit fireballs, the fusillade illuminating the wizards' faces with an eerie green light.
"Okay," Philip said. "Martin, get in there and keep Jimmy occupied. I doubt he'll ghost you, at least not right away. He'll want to play with you, maybe turn you to his side. Try to get him talking. Whatever you do, try to do it in public. Jimmy wants people to think he's a hero, so he won't do anything too underhanded if people are watching. I know the coordinates to my shop by heart. Transporting a car one piece at a time takes a lot of trips. Jeff, Gwen, and Felix will send us all there one by one, and we can use my computer to figure out the coordinates and do a group transport to come help you."
"Your computer is a Commodore 64. I don't think the help will come very fast," Martin said.
"Hey, don't knock it. I could have a VIC-20.
A mournful voice from the back of the pack said,
"Hey, I love my VIC-20.
Philip continued.
"You up for this?"
"Why not?" Martin answered. "What's the worst that can happen?"
"He could kill you."
"See, that's not... Wait, what?"
"He could totally kill you,"
Philip reiterated.
"There's a spell that would take you out instantly. The only challenge for Jimmy would be remembering the right words."
"Oh, yeah," Tyler said. "If you don't use a spell that often, the words just go bye-bye."
Gary said,
"Yeah, but if it's something as important as killing Martin, I'm sure Jimmy'd have the words written down."
"Obviously," Jeff agreed.
"Philip, why didn't you tell me there was a spell to kill people?" Martin sputtered.
"If you were me and you were training you, would you tell you that you could easily kill you at will?"
Martin asked after a moment.
"You meaning me or you meaning you?"
"Either way,"
Philip answered. Martin asked,
"Why am I doing this again?"
Gwen put her hand on Martin's arm and looked him in the eye, calming him instantly.
"Martin, when he finds out the orcs failed to kill us, he'll probably just do the job with the shell, and we won't be able to defend ourselves. Someone's got to get in there and distract him until the rest of us can find our way in, and your phone's the only device that can do it that quickly."
Philip said,
"Just go in and get him out in public. Keep him occupied, and we'll be there as fast as we can."
Martin opened the imp box and pressed the glowing screen of his phone a few times. His eyes darted to Gwen's just in time to see her look away. He looked at Philip and said,
"I love this plan. I'm excited to be a part of it. Let's do it."
Philip said,
"Ghostbusters."
He smiled, part out of admiration, part because he was delighted to get a pop culture reference for once. Martin pressed the screen of his phone and disappeared. He reappeared, standing roughly where Jimmy had stood when he turned the orcs on them. He was on the other side of the barrier. The wizards watched as Martin flew into the air, then swung around and accelerated toward the castle.
"Do you think he can do it?"
Gwen asked. Philip smiled.
"His job is to draw attention to himself and get into trouble. I don't think he's capable of not doing it."
27. Before Martin flew to the castle, he wheeled around to get a look at the wizards. They were a small clump of people, surrounded by a chaotic mass of enraged two-dimensional demons. He noted that Philip and Gwen were both watching him. Martin turned toward the castle and accelerated. He had full shell access and the use of all of the macros in the system. As he flew low over the rooftops, he muttered,
"Chi tui iras a la dec unu,"
the trigger phrase for a macro he'd found while researching his salutation. It was a bit of Gary's handiwork. Anything he said now would be amplified to the approximate volume of a speed metal concert. Martin shouted,
"Merlin!"
in the angriest sounding voice he could muster, and repeated it every few seconds, almost like a siren. He wanted Jimmy to feel the same feeling in the pit of his stomach Martin felt when he was being chased by the federal agents, what felt like years ago. He streaked across the medieval skyline, a silver blur, shrieking Merlin's name with eardrum-shattering intensity. Not a single living thing was unaware of him. Countless items were dropped as people put their hands to their ears and looked to the sky, just a moment too late. He was moving too quickly to easily track. All eyes turned to where Martin had just been. Martin slowed as he approached the castle, then stopped so suddenly that he nearly lost his grip on his staff. He swung for a moment as his body's momentum spent itself. Finally, he settled to a standing position, hovering 50 feet in the air above the front courtyard. The guards stood their ground, but they didn't look happy about it. Martin let out another ear-splitting, "Merlin!" The guards seemed to hear a sound too faint and distant for Martin to pick up. They looked behind themselves, then parted. Jimmy, looking very small, slid into view, covering a space of several yards in a single step. With a second step, he glided through the arch and stopped in front of the castle entrance. He cleared his throat, then in a voice much calmer but every bit as loud, said,
"Martin! Good to see you! Do come in!"
Martin had designed his salutation to be modular. In this situation, the parts where he transported himself to the stage area, transported himself away unseen, and watched the statue breakdance autonomously would not be needed. A good key phrase for a macro should be something that is memorable in times of stress, but that you're unlikely to say in normal conversation. Martin said,
"Groovy."
Immediately, lines delineating the rectangular shapes of boxes started tracing the contours of his form. As he fell from the sky, his body divided into hundreds of silver boxes, which dispersed, swirled, multiplied, and reformed into a 30-foot-tall version of Martin, which landed heavily in a 3-point crouch, holding its staff above and behind it with its right arm. Only the boxes that made up the hands, feet, and staff had any mass. The rest looked solid, but were without substance. Suspended at the point of center mass, Martin floated, mimicking the 3-point crouch. Any motion Martin made, the statue made. Martin had tested it with a doll-sized test version of the statue, but he'd never tried it at scale and was nervous about his ability to walk. He avoided the problem by flying. He launched himself straight at the entrance and Jimmy. He barreled forward, the statue skimming only a few feet above the cobblestones. His massive right hand grasped Jimmy and lifted him roughly. Since he was entering with Merlin, the shell didn't stop him as he streaked through the arch and tumbled gracelessly through the antechamber. He ground to a stop in the great hall, his massive feet sliding on the marble floor. As he stopped, he flung Jimmy with great force toward that far wall. He knew that with the shell enabled, Jimmy would not be damaged. It would hurt, but Jimmy had earned some hurt. As he let go, he heard Jimmy say something. It sounded like groovier, which made no sense. As Jimmy hurtled forward, his body glowed blue and shattered into hundreds of glowing blue plasma balls. The sphere swirled and multiplied before reforming into a 40-foot-tall statue of Jimmy. Giant Jimmy hit the far wall, but with most of the force dissipated. He came to a rest standing with his massive feet on either side of the throne.
"How do you like my new macro?" Merlin asked. "I made it myself from parts I found in the shell. Oh, and I want you to know that I appreciate you calling me Merlin."
"Yeah, I was being sarcastic," Martin groaned.
Back in the center of the writhing mass of silent demons, the wizards were making slow progress. Gwen, Jeff, and Felix were transporting wizards to Philip's shop as fast as they could, but with text editors and access to the raw file, it was a slow process. They had to work with each individual wizard to find their entry, then manually enter the coordinates for Philip's shop. It would have been difficult work in a quiet study. Standing in a field, being silently attacked by ineffectual demons, and working on tiny smartphone screens made it much harder. Hearing Martin's shouting, followed by silence, had made it nearly impossible. Philip did some quick math. Assuming 22 wizards, taking at least 30 seconds to transport each, then using his computer to dig up safe transport coordinates, it wouldn't help Martin if his rescue brigade materialized in the middle of a wall. He figured it would be well over 5 minutes before they got him any help. Philip listened for a moment. In the distance, he heard crashing noises and amplified grunts. They had to get help to Martin faster.
"How many have we transported so far?"
he asked. Gwen was peering at the phone screen. One of the Parisian wizards was standing closer than he really needed to, looking over her shoulder to help isolate his file entry. She answered,
"Four,"
without looking up.
"Okay, change of plan. Jeff, Felix, keep sending people to my shop. Gwen, you're going to send me to the shop, then you'll follow. I have an idea."
Martin could see Jimmy suspended in the torso of Giant Jimmy. Martin had to admit that the matrix of glowing blue plasma balls made for an impressive statue, especially when it was sprinting across the massive golden marble expanse of the great hall of the Castle Camelot, intent on doing him harm. Martin barely managed to get Giant Martin up on 1 foot and 1 knee before Giant Jimmy was on top of him. Martin put up his hands, catching Jimmy's as they came down with tremendous force. Martin held Jimmy at bay, the two massive forms held in stalemate. Within their giant effigies, Martin and Jimmy could see each other, one looking through a screen of floating plasma balls, the other through a field of silver boxes.
"You didn't create that!"
Martin said, straining to hold Jimmy at bay.
"All you did was take something I created and change it!"
"Yes, I changed it into something new!"
Jimmy said, bearing down with all of his strength.
"Something better that I made!
I created this macro. I came up with the idea. I invented the control scheme. I animated the transition."
"Yes, and I thank you for your assistance,"
Jimmy said, with an innocent expression that Martin thought just might be genuine. Martin shifted his weight to the right and let all of the strength go out of his arms. Jimmy fell forward and rolled to the side and away from Martin. As he clumsily got Giant Martin up on his feet, he hissed,
"You have no originality." "That's ridiculous,"
Jimmy said as he rolled on the ground. Martin stood over him, brandishing his staff, and shouted,
"This castle, the hobbits, the orcs, my macro, even your name, everything you do is a copy."
Jimmy sprawled on the ground, flailing wildly for a moment before managing to maneuver Giant Jimmy into a low crouch.
"And I was the first person to put it all together,"
Martin thought.
"I gotta keep him occupied and get him out in public if I can."
He glanced around the hall. People were starting to gather in the doorways and outside the gigantic windows that lined the walls. He took a clumsy step backward with his right foot to adjust his stance and said,
"There's more to innovation than just putting other people's ideas together like Lego bricks."
He adjusted his grip on his staff, holding it near its base with both hands. He swung it like a baseball bat with all of his force, aimed squarely for the real Jimmy at the core of Giant Jimmy. Jimmy saw it coming and took a single step backward. Being Jimmy, that single step took Giant Jimmy all the way to the back of the hall, leaving Giant Martin to cope with the momentum of the swing. Martin spun clumsily, lost his footing, and fell to the marble floor.
"You make a valid point," Jimmy said. "My innovation wasn't to do what everyone else did. My innovation was to do it better."
Philip appeared in the secret upstairs annex of his shop and was immediately horrified. 4 wizards were sent there before him with the instructions to use his Commodore 64 to try to find a safe teleportation point into Camelot. The first wizard to be transferred, David, the Russian lady killer, had made a beeline for the computer and was hard at work. The next 3 wizards, the 2 Magnuses and Sergio from Italy, had clearly decided that David had matters well in hand, and that the best thing they could do was make themselves at home. 1 Magnus was trying to pry the coin box of Philip's Gorf machine open to see if there were any quarters. The other was draped over Philip's white couch like a slab of melted cheese, his boots kicked up on the armrest. Sergio was sitting in the driver's seat of the Fiero, inspecting the interior with an amused scowl on his face.
"You! Feet off of my couch!"
Philip shouted.
"You! Out of my car!"
Sergio muttered, "Gladly," but didn't seem to be hurrying to comply. Philip turned his attention to the Gorf machine.
"Magnus, you can make all the gold you could ever need. Why would you even bother trying to steal from me?"
Magnus looked at Philip and said,
"I don't know. It's what you do, isn't it?"
He turned his attention back to trying to jimmy open the coin box. Gwen appeared. Philip spun around and said,
"See why I tried to keep this a secret?"
Gwen held up her hands and said,
"You're preaching to the choir."
Jeff and Felix were still sending wizards over, so it was no surprise when Kirk appeared. He spun slowly in awe, then said,
"Wow, it's like I'm watching an episode of Miami Vice."
Couch Magnus said,
"Really? I think it's kind of dated and sad."
"That's what I meant,"
Kirk replied.
"Okay, Gwen," Philip said. "Now we have to get to my hut."
"Do you know the coordinates?"
"Not off the top of my head," Philip said as he ran to the rollaway garage door built into the wall. "If I did, we'd have just gone straight there. And we have to get there as soon as possible, and we can't get the coordinates because my computer is occupied."
He hefted the door up on its rollers. It slid smoothly along tracks on the ceiling, exposing a mass of sturdy-looking oak planks. He backed up, took a moment to gather his strength, then ran into the planks with his shoulder, causing them to break free of the door frame and tip forward at hinges built into their base. The planks stopped with a dull whoomp, forming a ramp between the second floor of Philip's shop and the crest of the steep hill behind it. Philip opened the passenger door of the Fiero and made an inviting motion with his other hand toward Gwen, like a doorman helping a lady into a cab.
"Can I offer you a ride in my car?"
Philip asked. Sergio, still in the driver's seat, said,
"Cool. Where are you gonna sit, Phil?"
Martin had to admit Jimmy had improved on his macro. Not only was Giant Jimmy larger, stronger, and flashier than Giant Martin, but Jimmy's signature glide step was a superior means of locomotion when compared to Martin's technique of flailing his arms while struggling to maintain his balance. Jimmy was playing with him. He would drift effortlessly from one corner of the Great Hall to another, and Martin, standing in the center of the room, would laboriously turn to face him. A few times Jimmy cut diagonally across the room, forcing Martin to defensively leap out of his way, then clamber back to his feet. It was all the more embarrassing for Martin because of the spectators. Looking at the windows and doors, it seemed to Martin that the castle's entire staff was watching Jimmy make a monkey of him.
"Not bad," he thought. "But if we're ever going to draw a proper crowd, I need to get him outside."
Giant Jimmy was bouncing lightly on the balls of his feet. Martin could just pick out Jimmy's face peering out from between the glowing blue orbs. Since he wrote the macro to begin with, he knew that the spheres that made up Giant Jimmy were transparent from Jimmy's point of view, much like the boxes that made up Giant Martin were to him.
"You should have joined me, Martin,"
Jimmy said, moving gracefully across the far end of the Great Hall.
"I really could have used someone with your skills."
Jimmy launched Giant Jimmy at Giant Martin with surprising speed. Martin ducked, barely evading Giant Jimmy's arm as Jimmy attempted to clothesline Giant Martin on his way across the room. Martin smiled bitterly and turned toward Jimmy while remaining in his crouch. He made a show of looking over Giant Jimmy from head to toe, then said,
"Seems to me you already did." "Why is everyone so hung up on who came up with an idea? In the end, nothing could be less important. It's who utilizes an idea that matters. Inventing isn't nearly as important as using."
"What an eloquent way to sum up your worldview," Jimmy said.
"Thank you,"
and launched Giant Jimmy at Martin again. This time, since Giant Martin was hunkered down in a crouch, Jimmy swung his giant staff at him like a hockey stick. Martin sprung into the air. Giant Martin mimicked the movements of Martin's actual limbs on a much larger scale, and in the process multiplied the forces involved. Since the only parts of Giant Martin that had mass were the hands, feet, staff, and Martin's comparatively tiny real body suspended inside Giant Martin's torso, that meant that a leap that would make Martin fly 2 feet into the air sent Giant Martin rocketing into the gold-plated rafters of the Great Hall. He tried to grab the rafters, but only managed to give himself an awkward spin as he fell back to the floor 100 feet below. He landed on his side, then struggled to regain his footing. Giant Jimmy was again standing at the throne end of the hall, bobbing lightly with bent knees, the way actors do when they are playing a ninja. Martin could hear the people watching, laughing at him.
"That was not meant as a compliment," Martin said. "The best compliments seldom are," Jimmy replied. "You lied to me, Jimmy.
When you asked me to join you, you said you wanted to make a better future.
And who's to say I haven't?
The orcs! Jimmy laughed.
That's just silly! The orcs don't talk, or at least they won't when they're finished.
Martin righted himself and faced Jimmy, ready for the next attack.
You really don't get it,
Jimmy said, as if he was only now understanding Martin's confusion.
Martin, nothing we do affects the future at all. We've proven that. Not only is there no reason not to change things, knowing what we know, it's our moral duty to change things. I talked the king into ordering people to boil their water and to discard spoiled food. I got slavery outlawed. You don't hear Philip complaining about that, do you? Sure, the hobbits and the elves are a bit silly, but if we're going to improve the world, why shouldn't we have fun doing it? Think of the possibilities. I plan to put an end to the Crusades. Then I'll prevent the Inquisition. Imagine a renaissance where someone with unlimited funds lets Da Vinci build whatever he wants, where Michelangelo was never without a commission. What if, when the New World was discovered, the Native Americans had horses and guns? Let's find out! Picture World War I with armored blimps! What if Adolf Hitler's parents had an unfortunate accident and he got adopted by a nice Jewish family? I have seen the future, Martin. And it's a better past.
After a moment's thought, Martin said,
Jimmy, I won't be a part of this.
Jimmy said,
And you've convinced me that you shouldn't. Well done.
And hurled Giant Jimmy at Giant Martin with all of his strength. Giant Martin was standing flat-footed in the middle of the hall, holding his staff at waist height with both hands. Jimmy was aiming high this time, and it was clear to everyone that Martin would not be able to dodge. Jimmy's aim was spot on, and Giant Jimmy's left fist flew with staggering force into Giant Martin's face. Since Jimmy had forgotten what he was doing and punched one of the many parts of Giant Martin that had no mass, his fist streaked through Giant Martin's head as if he had punched a cloud of smoke. Martin, meanwhile, reversed his right hand's grip on the staff, took a single step backward with his left foot, and as Giant Jimmy flew past, Martin swung the giant staff, the bust of Santo on the end acting as a counterweight, and struck real Jimmy in the small of the back. The blow added a substantial amount of momentum to Jimmy's already out-of-control trajectory, sending him screaming and flying toward the entry hall. Spectators dove to the side as Giant Jimmy skidded and tumbled through the antechamber and back out into the courtyard. Martin said,
I'm glad we've come to an agreement.
He pointed his staff forward, and Giant Martin flew out of the great hall. The streets of Leadchurch were not particularly full, but still the sight of a white Pontiac Fiero tearing through at speeds of up to 40 miles per hour had caused a great many people to scream, then dodge, then scream again. Inside the car, Philip looked like a kid in a candy store, and Gwen sounded like a mother who didn't want to buy any candy.
What in the world? Why is the music so loud?
She asked.
It isn't,
Philip explained, cranking on the wheel.
It seems loud because the speakers are built into the headrests. Isn't it awesome?
It might be if you were playing something good,
Gwen said, gripping the dashboard for dear life. Philip steered the car sideways through a sliding turn while explaining,
That's Genesis! It's called That's All! It's a song of love and loss and a relationship turned sour!
Does Phil Collins write songs about anything else?
He doesn't have to. He's so good at writing good songs about bad relationships, to do anything else would be a waste of talent. It's a great song. In the video, the whole band was dressed up like bums.
As a chicken bounced off of the windshield, Gwen asked,
Why? What do bums have to do with this song?
You know,
Philip said while the car skidded to a stop in front of his home.
I'm not sure.
The car had scarcely stopped before Philip threw the door open and ran into his house, taking his staff, which had lain across both of their laps and out of Gwen's window. Gwen followed, taking the time to look around at the frightened villagers, eyeing the Fiero like it was a vicious beast, which they probably thought it was.
Don't worry, she said. It can't hurt you.
She remembered Philip's driving, then added,
When it's still. It can't hurt you when it's still. If you see it moving, run and hide.
Gwen entered Philip's home and found him hastily untying the knots that fastened a heavy canvas hammock suspended in the corner.
What are you doing?
She asked. One end of the hammock came loose and fell to the floor. Philip lunged to the other end and started to work on the knots, mumbling,
Martin's been using this tarpaulin as a hammock, but I need it now.
A few seconds later, the hammock was no more, and Philip had a tarp tucked under his arm. He scurried over to a trunk that sat in the corner near the cold fireplace. He rummaged furiously, let out a triumphant shout, and came up with a coil of rope.
All right, he said. We're ready to go.
Where are we going?
Gwen asked. Philip squinted, set his jaw, pointed to a door that was not the entrance, and said,
To the bathroom.
Gwen grimaced and said,
Ew.
Giant Jimmy ground to a stop in the front courtyard of the Castle Camelot, after tumbling through the entry arch and sliding for some distance. He had just enough time to get up on all fours before Martin was on him again. Jimmy had demonstrated that the giant forms flew more gracefully than they walked. It was a lesson Martin took to heart. Giant Martin barreled out of the castle, skimming the ground, and grabbed Jimmy with his free hand as he passed. As Jimmy left the ground, Giant Jimmy went with him, mimicking every move Jimmy made. Martin shot up at a 45-degree angle. Almost instantly, they reached an altitude of 100 feet, and Martin employed the first maneuver he had learned, albeit by accident. He pulled his staff arm inward as if to shield his face. The staff's airspeed dropped to nothing, then to full reverse, as it had the day he learned to fly. Again, Martin's body cracked like a whip. This time he kept his grip on the staff, but he deliberately let go of Jimmy. Giant Martin hung in space from his hovering staff and watched as Giant Jimmy splatted against the inside surface of Camelot's golden wall, then slowly slid down to the ground. Martin adjusted his pose to look a little more heroic and floated, waiting, while Giant Jimmy groaned and rolled on the ground, stunned. Jimmy crawled over and sat heavily on the ground, his back resting against the wall. Clearly, hitting the wall had knocked the fight out of him. Martin looked around. The tops of the walls were lined with the soldiers enjoying the best view in the house. The gate held back a sizable crowd, not that any of them had any interest in getting closer. Martin felt a small pang of sympathy for his adversary. Jimmy wanted to be important, and who couldn't relate to that? Jimmy was learning the hard lesson that the things we do to make ourselves feel big end up making us look small. Giant Martin drifted in closer.
Had enough, Merlin?
Giant Jimmy's shoulders sagged. Jimmy laughed.
Yeah, I've had enough. Good. Let's go inside and wait for the others.
Giant Jimmy's hand slowly went up. Jimmy said,
In a second. There's just one thing I want to do.
He made a fist and thrust it toward Martin, shouting,
Shroubo V!
Something, a force field, a shockwave, a wrecking ball, something hit Martin with tremendous force. As he flew helplessly through the air, he was dimly aware that Giant Martin had dissipated. His body hit the wall of the castle just above the entry arch and fell to the ground below. As he rolled on the ground, struggling to catch his breath, he saw the blue mass of glowing orbs that formed Giant Jimmy closing on him fast. He felt the giant hand close around him, and then he was streaking across the courtyard again, hitting the far wall and falling to the ground.
Such a waste,
Jimmy said as he rushed toward Martin again. Martin was lifted and thrown again too quickly for his brain to process the sensations. As he sailed through the air, hit the castle wall, and fell to the cobblestones below, he heard Jimmy still talking.
And now you learn the central truth of your friend Philip's life. He never really does anything.
Then Martin was streaking through the air into the wall and down to the ground again.
He watches,
Jimmy continued,
while other people do things and he complains about it. Sure, he felt just as strongly as you did that I needed to be stopped.
Martin sailed across the courtyard again. He was getting to where he was hardly aware of it.
But you're the one here getting used as a racquetball. And where is he? Somewhere far away, probably saying something snide.
Jimmy threw Martin again, with extra force this time, as if he were throwing Philip at Philip.
He's perfectly happy to let others take all of the risks, but he resents anyone who claims the rewards.
Martin lay, a crumpled mess on the ground. He was stunned and in great pain, but some part of his brain knew that he was not injured. Giant Martin was gone, but his invulnerability remained. Perhaps other things still worked. He lifted his staff into the air and said,
"Floogie."
A different part of his brain was not at all surprised when nothing happened. Giant Jimmy stood over Martin, giving him time to realize just how doomed he was. Martin employed the only means of escape his brain could provide in its current state. He crawled. Martin scarcely noticed when Jimmy deactivated Giant Jimmy, landing lightly on the ground next to Martin, who continued crawling, his head slowly clearing, while Jimmy followed. Jimmy explained in a calm voice.
"While your friends have spent the last few years sewing robes, building cars, and making their homes look like Ozzy Osbourne album covers, I've spent my free time creating shell commands that only I can access."
Martin continued crawling and groaned.
"You all agreed that you wouldn't do that."
"Which is often your first hint that you should do something."
Jimmy shook his head, casually stalking.
"It's just so sad."
Martin asked,
"What is?"
Martin collided with something. He looked up. He had crawled directly into the stone rim of the pool that surrounded the golden statue of the old king, the young king, and Jimmy. Every part of Martin that he could feel hurt. He flopped over and sagged onto the ground, leaning against the rim of the pool. Jimmy looked down at him.
"Martin, you've thrown your life away. You must see that. There's no way this can end well for you. And what did you do it for? Nothing."
"Some things are just wrong, Jimmy."
"Yes, and destroying yourself for no good reason is one of them."
Martin shook his head.
"Jimmy, you killed a town. A town, Jimmy, dead. You did that. For what? Because you like Tolkien? Your hobbits died. Your orcs are in constant pain. God knows how the elves are doing."
"They're fine. You'll forgive me if I don't take your word for it. Jimmy, you've killed or injured hundreds of innocent people. That's why I came here. And that's not nothing."
"Yes, it is, Martin. Yes, it is. Look around you."
Jimmy gestured toward the crowd beyond the gate and the soldiers watching from the top of the parapets. They still had a large audience. Their now non-amplified voices could not be heard from the distances involved, but they were still in plain sight. Martin and Jimmy were having a private conversation in front of a massive audience.
"Look at them, Martin. They don't know the truth, but you and I do. They aren't real. They aren't people. They're lines of code. They're information, and not very much of it. They're algorithms created automatically by another algorithm to accomplish who knows what, for we don't know who. What could be more unimportant, huh? What could be more insubstantial? They're not real, and nothing done by them or to them could possibly make any difference."
"They're just as real as you are,"
Martin spat.
"Yes, exactly. I'm not real either, and neither are you. Nothing any of us does matters. So why are we arguing about what I've done? And nobody else seems to understand this like I do."
Martin smiled.
"Which is often your first hint that you're wrong."
Jimmy shrugged, then pointed his staff at Martin as he lay prone on the ground.
"I can see I'm not going to change your mind, so I have to decide what to do with you. The way I see it, I have three options. I can strand you in your own time, which in your case means jail. I can let you stay in this time, stripped of all powers. It'll be a hard life, subsistence farming, but you'll have your freedom and you'll enjoy all the improvements I make to this timeline. Or maybe it'd be more humane to just kill you now. You wouldn't suffer, and you'd serve as an example to everyone else. What do you think, Martin? Prisoner? Peasant? Or..."
Jimmy pursed his lips. His head turned up to the left, lost in thought. Finally, he said,
"Death."
Martin laughed.
"You couldn't think of a word for death that starts with P, could you?"
Jimmy laughed as well.
"No, I couldn't."
But, as we've established, it doesn't really matter.
A voice said,
"Passed away!"
Both Martin and Jimmy looked to the top of the statue. The golden, muck-covered head of Merlin was draped with what looked to be a tarp, a rope draped down off of the statue's head, over the shoulder and down its front to the water. The other end of the rope seemed to disappear into thin air a few feet above the statue. Philip stood on the statue's shoulder, holding the rope with one hand and his staff with the other. He looked pretty pleased with himself. Martin was surprised to see Jimmy smile.
"Philip! I really should have guessed it was you vandalizing my statue. It's about the right maturity level. I should be mad, but I'm just too delighted at the symbolism of you appearing on that statue's head along with all the other crap. Tell me, how'd you climb down a rope carrying your staff?"
"I had Gwen drop it down to me when I was almost to the bottom."
"Ah," Jimmy said. "Is she coming as well?"
"Soon enough,"
Philip said, before saying,
"Flugi,"
and using his staff to glide down to the ground, forming a triangle between himself, Jimmy, and Martin.
"I'm glad you're here, Philip. You're just in time to watch me dispatch your sidekick."
"I'm not his sidekick," Martin protested. "If anything, he's my sidekick."
"Yes, of course," Jimmy said. "Everyone remembers how Batman was Robin's trainee."
When Philip and Jimmy were done laughing, Philip said,
"I can't let you do that, Jimmy."
For a long moment, Jimmy and Philip stared at each other, their faces illuminated by the cheesy plasma ball at the end of Jimmy's staff. Jimmy broke the silence.
"You can't let me do it, but you can't stop me from doing it either. You won't ghost me, you won't kill me, you can't hurt me, you can't stop me."
"I don't know," Philip said. "Maybe I've learned to be a little more like you."
"Philip, if that's true, I've already won."
Philip looked at Martin, then looked back to Jimmy.
"You're right. I won't ghost you. I won't kill you. I can't injure you. But I can hurt you."
With shocking speed, Philip swung his staff with all of his might. The head of the staff traced a graceful arc, striking Jimmy on the bridge of the nose. The bottle shattered on impact, and while the shards of glass could not pierce Jimmy's skin, the 10-year-old Tabasco sauce it held easily penetrated the membranes of his eyes, nose, and mouth. Jimmy dropped his staff and clutched at his face, then shrieked, gasping and coughing. He stumbled and fell to the ground, writhing in helpless agony. 28. An hour later, every wizard in Europe had managed to find his way back into Camelot. With that many people working on the problem, and Eddie to act as a guide, it didn't take long to reinstate the shell, deactivate all of Jimmy's macros, and remove the exclusion field from around the city. That all handled, it was time to turn to the task of punishing Jimmy. Philip made no effort to hide his glee. When he was asked to try, he pointed out that his obvious enjoyment of Jimmy's punishment was an important part of said punishment. They gathered in Jimmy's office. The only surprising bit was Eddie. He was angrier than anyone. He'd acted as a glorified secretary for years, hoping that someday Jimmy would let him in on his amazing plans. Then, all in one day, Eddie found out that the great man shared his scheme with someone else on a whim, that the plan itself was abhorrent and immoral, and that his mentor and closest friend was all too happy to see him torn to shreds by fake orcs with all of the other wizards. The wizards engaged in some heated deliberation in Jimmy's former office, while Jimmy was stored safely on the floor of his former waiting room, hogtied, naked, with a gag in his mouth. Finally, they brought him in to share their thoughts. The model of the new Europe was removed from the conference table. Jimmy was placed there instead. Jimmy's face was still stained red and streaming tears, but he'd regained some of his composure. They could easily send Jimmy back to his original time and place, but they had to make sure that he received some punishment for what he had done once he got there. Nobody was surprised to hear that Philip had some ideas. Gwen's levitation spell was used to hold Jimmy helpless in midair. Philip climbed up on the table behind Jimmy. He removed his hat and pulled out two fat grease markers, one green, the other yellow. Philip took his time, writing Brazil in large green letters, then used the yellow marker to write number one.
I looked up the day you left your time, Jimmy. Did you know that on that exact date there's a massive rally in Buenos Aires to show support for the Argentinian national football team? It seems they were about to play their arch-rivals, the Brazilians. Have you ever been to Argentina? It's a lovely country, full of strong, healthy, passionate people, most of whom hate the Brazilians with the intensity of a thousand suns.
As Philip clambered down off of the table, Tyler spoke.
I wanted to ghost you, for at least as long as you ghosted me for. They all talked me out of it. Instead, we pumped up your magnetic field so strong that any electronic device within 10 feet of you would stop functioning, just like we did with Todd.
Tyler walked up close to Jimmy, savoring the only satisfaction he was likely to get.
You can't use a computer. You can't use a phone. If you try to get anyone to help you, it'll be by writing a letter or speaking to them in person. Either way, you'll sound insane. As you know, we've reset your stats to the original factory settings. You're aging again. You're able to get hurt. For Todd, we all figured that was a sufficient punishment. But you have a talent for getting people to do what you want. That's why we're stranding you in South America. You don't speak Spanish, do you? No, you don't. You'll spend the rest of your life an illegal immigrant in the penal system of a foreign nation where you don't speak the language, and everyone thinks you're insane. But you'll remember your time as Merlin. It's not quite like being a ghost, but it's close enough for me.
Eddie ungagged Jimmy, leaving him hanging in space. Jimmy knew better than to struggle. He was stuck, and any attempt to unstick himself would just entertain his captors. He looked at Philip and said,
"We'll meet again, you know."
Philip stepped forward and pointed his staff at Jimmy.
"Yes, in 800 years or so. Anything you want to say before we send you to your fate?"
"Yes."
"Too bad,"
Philip said, and sent Jimmy on his way. Eddie led Philip, Martin, and Gwen to the private chambers of the royal family. They weren't surprised to find that while they were very luxurious by medieval standards, they were a hovel compared to Jimmy's accommodations. King Stephen had died long ago. King Arthur, a thin young man in his early 20s, with a confused manner and large, questioning eyes, shared his quarters with his mother, the regally passive Queen Matilda. Eddie explained that Merlin was gone. King Arthur nodded and asked what that meant. Eddie explained that Merlin had left and wasn't coming back, ever. The king nodded, squeezed his mother's hand, thought for a moment, and asked more emphatically,
"What does that mean?"
Eddie explained that Merlin wasn't going to be around to help him, and that life would go back to the way it was before Merlin arrived. Arthur said,
"But I wasn't the king before he arrived."
It was clear that without assistance, the monarchy would fall. That wouldn't be so bad, except that it would drag the rest of Europe into decades of bloody warfare with it. It was a terrible mess, but the wizards couldn't in good conscience just stand back and watch as the Merlin vacuum destroyed the fledgling Western civilization. It was decided that the wizards would elect a new chairman to act in the wizards' interests and to help prop up and guide the royal family into self-sufficiency. When time came to pick a chairman, everyone wanted to know what Philip thought, which said more than a vote ever could. Philip had no interest in living in Camelot, so his first act as chairman was to order Martin to act as his liaison to the royals, with Eddie's assistance. Martin argued, but Philip was firm.
"Martin, we all have to do our part. I don't want to be chairman, but that's what everybody wants, so I'm doing my duty."
Yes, but... Philip cut him off.
As chairman, I order you, Martin, to do your part. It just so happens that your part is to do the vast majority of my part.
The wizard split into two groups. One to go talk to Jimmy's attempted orcs, the other to go talk to the elves. The orcs were delighted to hear that they would be turned back to normal, but less happy to hear that it would take several weeks.